Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Object of Desire by Dal McLean, narrated by Gary Furlong. 1.
Dead? Come on, that's... Of course she's not dead.
She is.
Nick's voice, choked and shaky at the other end of a poor phone line.
God, Tom. She really is.
But I saw her yesterday, Tom insisted. Katrina, at the office. She was fine.
His stunned gaze skittered over his surroundings, trying to clutch onto normality. Grand, white colonnades, bleached render, yellowing grass, scorching July sunlight. Greenwich Riverside, with the glass and metal towers of Canary Wharf looming across the Thames. The gorgeous photographer Tom had been idly chatting up while he answered his phone, breaking down his gear a few yards away. An assistant waiting for Tom by a fold-up table, holding a bottle of makeup remover in one bored hand. Two gulls, startling white against startling blue, wheeling and crying over the river.
She's on the bed,
Nick's unwanted voice again, worming in his ear.
And there's so much blood. She's cold.
Tom drew in a sharp breath through his nose.
Have you called an ambulance?
Christ, Tom, of course I have. Please, please, I need you to come now.
Tom squeezed his eyes tight shut, until he saw sparkles behind his straining lids.
Don't say it. Don't you fucking say it. She's killed herself, Tom.
Nick's voice broke. Tom opened his eyes. Tom's hastily arranged cab arrived at Katrina's Clapham townhouse, seconds behind an ambulance that had clearly struggled to get there too. It was close to 4 o'clock after all, Saturday, people driving home from the shops. All the way from Greenwich, sitting impotently in the back of the cab as it hit traffic snarl up after snarl up, Tom had cursed the fact that he hadn't brought his bike to the shoot. But maybe it was as well. He was in no state to make split-second judgments. Tom and the taxi driver stared out for uncomfortable seconds at the obvious signs of crisis surrounding the house. The front door wide open, the police car outside. Tom's stomach was a tight, writhing ball of dread. Then the driver shook himself back to business.
That's, 3185, mate.
He sounded awkward, as if he felt embarrassed asking for payment in the circumstances.
Actually, just make it 30 quid, eh?
His voice was gruff with sympathy. The ambulance had double-parked beside Nick's black Porsche, and two crew members were already out on the road, equipment extracted, heavy doors thudding closed, as the men headed toward the house. Tom fumbled 2 £20 notes out of his wallet, shoved them through the open glass partition into the driver's startled hand, and scrambled out of the cab. Then he raced up the short path and into the house, hard on the heels of the ambulance crew. A young, uniformed first-response police officer stood in the sunlit hallway, but she wasn't quick enough to notice that Tom wasn't a paramedic too. So he was able to belt up the stairs behind the team unimpeded and follow them through the open doorway at the top. The smell hit him first, a thick, cloying blend of expensive perfume and corrupt metallic fruit. He saw Nick hunched against a far wall, body shaking with silent grief, eyes closed. Then he took in the rest. An all-white bedroom, glamorous and totally impractical, designed like something from a magazine, so that every dot of colour looked shocking. A painted wooden desk stood by the window, holding a silver laptop, the signature light green-blue of a Tiffany box, a stack of envelopes tied with a red cord, 5 little glass medical bottles lined up with matching purple bars on their labels. A familiar light blue dress lay draped over the arm of a padded armchair, a tiny tangle of lacy pink underwear on top. White walls, furniture, carpet, bedding. Everything was absurdly neat and clean, save the most demanding splash of colour. The huge stain, which covered the fluffy duvet like crimson dye. A palette of shades of red, in fact, as if the pool had dried gradually from the outside into the dark and clotted centre. Katrina lay on her side on top of it, in the middle of the wide bed facing the doorway. She was naked but utterly sexless, her skin like bleached ash against the wet red cloth. Her beautiful blank profile, eyes decently shut at least, rested on the purity of her pillow. Tom saw the guilty kitchen knife lying on the blood pool beside the upturned palm of her right hand, the mangled meaty churn of her inner wrists. Then the dark hole, visible through black blood-clotted ash-blonde hair, where her ear had been, the shockingly recognizable auricle resting near her fingertips. One of the paramedics called sharply.
Hey, you shouldn't be in here, mate!
Just as the uniformed police constable materialized behind Tom to pull him, unresisting, back into the hallway, and then down the stairs. At the bottom, Tom slurred out his name and address and the reason he was there. He didn't sound like himself at all, he thought distantly, but the officer noted it all down. Finally, she left him to perch on the pristine linen sofa in Katrina's airy sitting room, and he found himself stupidly anxious not to crease the fabric or mark its snowy perfection. He'd never been in this room before. In fact, he'd never been inside the house. The door into the hallway lay wide open, allowing Tom to see the bustle of comings and goings in the hallway, as the procedure surrounding an unexpected death snapped into place. All things he'd heard recounted before, but never actually witnessed. The first response officer, out of his eyeline, was speaking to her radio. Someone, a man, shouted instructions from upstairs as one of the paramedics barreled past the open door and out of Tom's vision, as if his urgency still had some point. Movement, back and fore, voices outside, inside. Tom forced desperate focus, made himself identify what was happening. Who was who as they passed? First onto Tom's little stage, a man he suspected to be the divisional pathologist, followed by a group of SoCo officers, silent and eerie in hooded white suits, ready to pick over the scene for evidence of anything that might turn out to be suspicious. Then, less than a minute after they disappeared, two men, clearly plain-clothed police officers. They stood in front of the open sitting room doorway, pulling on those same white forensic suits and overshoes, and Tom was almost certain they'd be the Advanced Homicide Assessment Team, from whichever murder investigation unit happened to be on call. Tom didn't recognize either of them, a dull, distant relief. Part of him was riveted, because after having heard it described so often, casually and not, it felt unreal seeing everything actually happen, like a dramatic performance put on specially for him. But as the two hat officers moved out of Tom's vision, another white-clad figure came in behind them, and as he passed the open sitting room door, he glanced in and caught sight of Tom. The man stopped and blinked. For a moment, Tom felt an audience's shock at having been acknowledged, and he shifted self-consciously under the man's startled stare. Then, as that stare turned to wide-eyed disbelief, Tom felt suddenly horribly aware of how incongruous he must look. His golden tan, his glossy, pale blonde shoulder-length hair, his long body, clad in an on-trend brown suede shirt and perfectly cut jeans, his obsessively precise grooming, a peacock sitting at the edge of a tragedy. It took whole seconds for Tom to understand that the man's reaction wasn't puzzlement. It was recognition. And finally, even under that disorientating, tightly drawn white hood, Tom recognized him in turn. Each man stared at the other as if a monstrous apparition had manifested in front of them. Des fucking Salt. Through surging panic, Tom took in the man's once familiar sharp features, his densely freckled skin, almost as white as the forensic hood concealing his wiry red hair. How the fuck hadn't he recognized him? Was it just the oddness of that hood, framing Salt's narrow face like a nun's coif? The relief Tom had felt just minutes before sneered at him now. Because yes, Tom had known there was a small chance they'd be involved. Of course he had. But how unlucky did he have to be? His face felt scalding hot, his guts skittering with a kind of death row anticipation. And inevitably his gaze shot to the hallway behind Salt. Because always with DC Des Salt came D.I. Will Foster. Tom's eyes fixed on that empty space like a mouse in front of a stoat. But nothing happened. He snapped his attention back to Salt, but Salt had turned away and walked out of Tom's field of vision. He could hear hushed voices, though, as Salt presumably asked the uniformed PC by the staircase what the fuck Tom was doing there. When Salt appeared again in the doorway, his expression had fixed into professional neutrality. He extracted a notebook from inside the opening of his forensic suit, pulled down his hood and walked in the room. "Mr. Gray," he said, It was stupidly shocking to hear his voice. Perhaps Tom had hoped it was all a lurid dream. Then he registered, Mr. Gray. They were going to pretend they didn't know each other then. Fine by him. But he couldn't help looking compulsively toward the open doorway before he focused again on Salt. I'm D.S. Salt with Southwark and Peckham Murder Investigation Team. Southwark and Peckham. That was new, at least. And so was the rank. He'd made sergeant. Salt's Northern Irish accent sounded as strong as it ever had, but Tom unwillingly noted tiny changes in him. New fine lines between his ginger brows. His unfortunate moustache had gone, as had that shy, awkward niceness he'd exuded once, so out of place on a policeman.
"Don't be alarmed, sir," Salt went on blandly. "This is all routine procedure in a case like this."
Of course it was, with all that blood. Tom involuntarily squeezed closed his eyes, and the image was starkly there, like a high-res photograph dropping in behind his lids. He thought he would never stop seeing it. His eyes sprang open. That was what mattered, what lay upstairs, not some soap opera from his past. Sick with himself, he forced his attention back to Salt.
"I know," he said.
Salt raised an eyebrow.
"You told the officer that you're here because Mr. Henning, Mr. Dominic Henning, requested you come to support him when he find the body of his wife, Katrina Henning."
Tom nodded, then said,
"Yes,"
aloud, as if he were being recorded.
"And what's your relationship to Mr. and Mrs. Henning?"
There was no one here to witness any recognition between them, but still Salt's tone remained that of a stranger.
Mr. and Mrs. Henning own one of the modelling agencies I work with. Echo, it's called.
This is Mrs. Henning's home.
Mr. Henning no longer lives here, is that correct?
Tom tightened his jaw.
Yes.
You must be a close friend as well as a client?
Salt began to write in his notebook.
For Mr. Henning to have called you here at a time like this.
Tom's mind darted around the question of how much total honesty could complicate things for Nick. But in the end all he said was,
Yes.
Salt glanced up, brown eyes narrowed, and Tom was sure Salt must be making those damning connections in his head. Tom and Nick Henning. Nick and Tom. Nick, whose wife had just killed herself. Of all people to judge him, it had to be Dez. Salt, though, didn't try to push him on it. Instead, when he finished scribbling his notes, he left the room until he could return with a forensics officer from the scene upstairs to take Tom's fingerprints, a swab of his cheek for DNA, and a print of his boot. For elimination purposes, Salt assured him. And all through the process, though Tom ignored him, he could feel Salt's narrow observation, as if he was taking mental notes. All the better to report back to his gov, Tom thought viciously, about what a wreaker of havoc Tom continued to be.
Right, thanks for your cooperation, Mr. Gray, Salt said, when the process ended.
And that appeared to be it. Salt gave a curt nod and turned to the door, and he still hadn't acknowledged their acquaintanceship. Tom stared at his retreating white-clad back, and he realized he had to have some certainty, rather than wasting even a second on top of everything else, fearing something that might not happen. He blurted,
Who's your SIO?
Salt halted and peered over his shoulder. He was frowning, as if for some reason that wasn't what he'd expected Tom to say. Then understanding visibly hit. Salt's lip curled.
If this turns into something, it'll be DCA Lawson, sir.
Tom could hear his contempt.
You're safe enough.
DCI Lawson. Tom didn't have a fucking clue who he was. He felt a nauseating rush of emotion, anticlimax perhaps, shame, all easily overwhelmed by a tsunami tide of relief that in this, at least, his luck had held, that on top of this catastrophe he wouldn't have to deal with Will Foster. That was the moment he heard the first sounds of Katrina's corpse being manhandled down the narrow staircase. Dull, obscene thumps, subdued curses, a quiet laugh. He moved in a daze to the open sitting room door, and stood beside Salt, watching, agonized, as the zipped, lumpen body bag was carried on a graceless stretcher, through the hall and out into the glorious, glorious sunlight. Tom sat in Katrina's drawing room, still waiting. It felt like hours since the ambulance had left with Katrina's body, and his mind remained fixed compulsively on the image of the obscene black bag. the uninterested hands carrying it, what was left of Katrina flopping inside. The last time he'd seen her, styled as always like an old-time movie goddess, sashaying down the corridor in her tight baby blue sheath dress, that delicate glacial elegance of hers, everything around her fastidious and impeccable, like this room, before it had been smeared with brutish black forensic powder. In the cab over from Greenwich, trying to prepare himself for what was coming, Tom had imagined he could predict how Katrina would have staged a final exit. He'd expected a carefully set scene of beautiful, useless tragedy, Grace Kelly as Ophelia, with or without the flowers. And he couldn't bear that she'd chosen to punish herself with such ugliness and indignity at her end. He rubbed a desperate hand over his face, trying to silence the chaos of guilt and regret in his mind. His palm came away with traces of melted foundation, a touch of dark mascara. The makeup assistant had given him wipes to get off the worst of it in the cab, and he'd tried, blind, but clearly he hadn't done that well. Salt must have thought he looked like a melted clown. He hadn't looked in the mirror for hours, he realized with a needle jab of self-contempt. Must be a crisis, then. Maybe, the thought struck treacherously from nowhere, maybe it actually wasn't such a good idea to hang around here anymore. Now everything had sunk in, surely Tom would be the last person Nick had wanted to see. Perhaps he should go home, he told himself, with a little shameful flip of hope. Tom? Tom's eyes jerked up to the doorway. Nick stood, silhouetted against the brightness of the hall. For a moment, Des Salt was a white ghost at his shoulder, before he turned and moved out of Tom's sight. Nick's short, dark blonde hair was still somehow in place, combed back off his forehead. He always carefully maintained a fine golden stubble, which set off his firm chin and gentle features, and beneath his Versace suit he had a tanned, gym-honed body that could give a swimwear model a run for his money. He was 7 years older than Tom, and very, very sexy, with something indefinable. Confidence, success, power, will, determination, protectiveness, any of them. Tom had never imagined seeing him like this, haggard and dazed. There was an awful silence, and Nick seemed to be waiting, as if he had expected Tom to say something, the right thing. But now the moment had come, what could possibly fit? I'm sorry. I'm sorry we drove your wife to suicide. Tom felt his face twist, almost spasm with distress, and he had to fight his expression back to neutrality. But Nick's eyes remained fixed on him, as if he were the only beautiful thing in an ugly landscape. Well, Tom told himself numbly as he rose to his feet, at least he'd made the right choice in waiting. 2. Seriously, Pez said from behind his new season Marc Jacobs shades. I still think I'm having some kind of lucid nightmare. It's actually yesterday morning, and I'm going to wake up and swear I'll never drink tequila again. Tom gave a wan smile and took a sip of coffee. They sat at a small, two-person table on a quiet pavement, shaded by a white canvas canopy. Café Otto, their usual haunt for daytime meets and good weather, not that far from Pez's flat in now-trendy Dalston. It had been Pez's discovery. Italian Vogue had once dubbed it the coolest café in Britain, and that had been more than enough for him. But though Tom would have been just as happy at a Costa, he never said it out loud because he knew these things should matter more to him, the way they did to Pez. As much as he'd tried, he'd never quite managed to get genuinely invested in clothes, in trends, in image. He just managed a reasonable facsimile of caring. 2 nights before, in another life, Tom and Pez had been on the tear together, and for Pez, tequila had definitely been involved. But Tom felt distantly as if those reckless memories belonged to someone else, as if he were watching the world through a window now, rather than living in it. He'd spent the night in Nick's flat in Notting Hill, in Nick's bed, the two of them lying side by side like a couple of naked corpses on a slab, holding hands. Tom hadn't slept, and in the morning, as Nick left to begin to tackle arrangements for when Katrina's body would be released, Tom cancelled his scheduled session with his personal trainer and texted Pez, desperate to meet. It was going to be a post-mortem, Tom said, and that was actually one of the least traumatizing things he and Nick had talked about the night before. It happens for unexpected and violent deaths. Tom even managed to sound matter-of-fact. But the truth was that, for all he tried, He couldn't convince himself of the intellectual case that it didn't matter to Katrina. She was an object now, and it kept on ice, waiting for the knife. It shouldn't matter that she would lose what was left of her precise feminine dignity, gutted like a beast on a mortuary table. But Tom felt, with preternatural sensitivity, the light warm breeze on his skin, and he smelled the scent of the city and tasted bitter coffee on his tongue, and he felt greedily, guiltily alive. "I still can't believe it," Pez repeated, filed off South London accent nipping in around the edges. "I mean..." He sighed and trailed off as the thought visibly struck him, and pulled off his shades to peer into his capacious leather man-bag. There was no denying that Pez was a striking guy. His dark hair was cut short at the sides and ferociously styled and gelled on top, and his large olive-green eyes were discreetly mascaraed and lined. He had a neat plush mouth, a small wide nose and flawless winter-pale skin. His features, put together, were interesting rather than beautiful, but his looks had won him work with plenty of indie brands and magazines in his time. A quirky editorial model's career was nearly always short, though, and Pez had been far too smart to wait for the axe to fall. So he talked his way into booking and management at Echo, and he was brilliant at it. Pez had actually been the one to spot Tom, playing football shirtless in Hyde Park, the summer he was supposed to begin his postgrad. He'd taken Tom's very first Polaroids. "Lower your chin, look up, don't smile." Tom still wasn't sure why he'd gone along with it. Pez had shown Katrina the test shots and called Tom to come into the office to meet her the very next day, and Tom could remember in perfect detail his first sight of her, what she'd worn, what she'd said, and how she'd said it. "A truly successful model is an object of desire, Tom," she'd told him. "Do you understand how subtle a concept that is to project? You have to create something that people can't help but want." How impressed he'd been by her Hitchcock blonde aloofness and stylized elegance, her bored cut-glass accent, all so different from the girls he knew from uni. How sparing she'd been with her flattery, and how much more any approval from her, relayed exclusively through Pez or Nick's sister Jenna, had come to mean to him. Pez, on the other hand, had always been the opposite of sparing. He'd bullshitted relentlessly about Tom's potential and managed to persuade him, on spec, onto a plane to New York City and an open call for what turned into his first major jeans campaign. Most male models started their careers broke and in debt to their agency, but Tom hadn't had the chance. He hadn't even had the chance to think it through. He'd signed to a big agency in New York as well as Echo. He'd managed to catch and, importantly, hold the interest of a slew of major brands, and he'd long since deferred his postgraduate place at University College London. Genuine friendships were rare in their business, but Tom and Pez weren't just model and manager using each other. They were the closest of friends who'd guarded each other's secrets. Maybe it helped that they were both gay, and also had excellent sex together when either of them needed it or wanted it. But whatever the reason, it worked. They loved each other, and they were both on the same page. None of the complications of romance, no would-be love affair. "I know I fucking brought it," Pez muttered, still rifling through his bag, and Tom began to drift, so tired he was ready to finally nod off right there. His phone, as if it had read his mind, began to buzz and jump spitefully on the table in front of him. Tom groaned, and when he saw the name on the display, he was more than tempted to ignore the call. But something, a craving for normality perhaps, prompted him to pick it up. "Hi, Dad." Tom thought he sounded pretty much as usual.
"Hi, Tom. Are you working?"
His father's voice was warm and deep, and accented like Tom's. Tom glanced up and caught Pez's eye. Pez grimaced, and Tom found he couldn't bear to tell his father what had happened. Couldn't face the concern, the questions, the unspoken, "How could you?" The parallels that had just struck him forcibly between his father and Katrina.
"No, I'm with a friend. Are you up to anything? Any plans?"
It was blind distraction without expectation, but his father surprised him.
"Well, actually, Bernie and Joan have invited me for dinner at their new place next weekend. An overnight stay. It's in Kent, Staplehurst. You know what?"
Tom's father said with bright defiance.
"I think I'll go."
Tom suppressed a weary sigh.
"That's great, Dad. And maybe you could ask Joan to invite a single lady friend, too."
"Tom," his father said with fond reproach.
And he didn't need to go any further. They both knew Alistair Gray had no interest in saving himself or in moving on. It felt as always to Tom as if they were reciting lines from a bad play, and he couldn't miss any of his cues. His father didn't miss his either.
"I have some mail for your mum. Have you heard from her?"
Tom let his head fall back until he was looking up at the underside of the white linen umbrella, minutely spotted with dark mould.
"No, Dad," he said. "Not since she called from Nice. I told you, she said Richard wanted to try Monaco."
His father laughed shakily, trying his useless, brave face.
"I'd never have imagined your mum on a boat. She doesn't like the water much."
But she liked money, and glamour, and excitement and deception, as she'd proved over and over again. His father sniffed quietly, and Tom couldn't stand it.
"I have to go, Dad. Sorry. I'll ring you soon."
He listened to his father's startled goodbyes, then cut the call. Pez gave him a "poor you" moue. He knew all about Tom's parents.
"Anyway,"
Pez nudged Tom's hand hard with the side of a small box-shaped package he'd finally extracted from his bag.
"Someone left this for you at reception."
The parcel had been wrapped neatly in classic brown paper, tastefully stained navy blue. Tom eyed it with apathy. He got a lot of presents, a lot of samples. Pez prompted.
"Well?"
Tom shrugged one shoulder.
"Oh, for fuck's sake, give it here."
With an irritated humph, Pez snatched up the package and tore off the paper.
"If your fans send you stuff, the least you can do is take a look. I will never forget the box of cheese that French guy sent you after Fashion Week last year, which you left in the office unopened till Jenner had to break into it because it smelled like a corpse."
Tom flinched, but Pez was focused on the box that his deft fingers had pulled from the paper. Robin's egg blue embossed with black.
"Ooh, nice, Tiffany."
He shoved the box over to Tom.
"Open it then."
Tom stared at it, repelled seeing that same splash of Tiffany blue in Katrina's white and red bedroom. He blinked hard and forced himself to pick up the box and pull off the lid. It revealed a broad brown leather cuff with a large, sleek fastening in what looked like copper. Beautiful.
"That's the Paloma Picasso line,"
Pez breathed with reverence, because there wasn't a trend in the world he wasn't on top of.
"The rose gold design. Tommy, that's £2,000. Who's it from?"
Pez scrabbled first through the wrapping paper, then reached for the box. Tom watched his urgency with no excitement of his own to offer in return.
"No card,"
Pez pulled back with a pout of disappointment.
"Who pays that kind of money without trying for a shag?"
Tom rubbed the tips of his fingers across his brow.
"No one does. It's a fake."
The metal of the bracelet glowed softly in Pez's hand as he held it close to his face and scrutinized it, like a gems dealer sizing up a dodgy diamond.
"It looks real. The gold looks real. Hang on, there's an inscription."
He raised his eyebrows and handed it wordlessly to Tom. There were small italicized letters engraved on the metal fastening. "I want you more." Tom rolled his eyes and shook his head as he dropped the bracelet back into its box. He just couldn't be bothered. Not today, with blind adulation from people who imagined they knew him through photoshopped images and the odd sanitized interview. From what his social media manager posted for him online.
"I can't accept that. If it's real, it's too much. And that inscription. I don't want to encourage whoever it is."
Pez gaped with an exaggerated shock as he latched on to the one part of Tom's protest that seemed to matter.
"Too much, darling. You're a model."
He huffed an impatient sigh as Tom failed to react.
"It's totally you. I mean, you could have bought it for yourself," he coaxed.
Tom thought this belief in his own subtlety was almost endearing.
"Go on, Tommy. A piece like that's a little symbol of success."
Tom nodded because he couldn't be bothered arguing, and when Pez handed him the box, he took it. He'd put it in a drawer when he got home. There was a short, waiting silence.
"So, are you all right?"
Pez asked, and at long last it seemed they were going to talk about it properly. The very large elephant in the corner of the room.
"Me?"
Tom scoffed, and perversely, his immediate urge was to deflect.
"What about you? You worked with her every day for years."
Pez sighed again, Tommy, come on.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?